Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing issues that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening, we haven't prepared this, so I don't know what to say.
Hey, welcome to episode 40-something of Slaughter.
Yep.
Lucy's not really here today. I've got a little sound box that's going to go, yep. Oh my God. And
we could do that and then just record it in our own houses.
Yeah. We'd never have to see each other again. If you are listening, you'll know that this is the re-record.
Yeah, because we fucked up.
So, I'll be honest, I have the memory of an absolute goldfish, so do not assume at any point that this is rehearsed, this is acting. I have forgotten everything about Lucy's story and almost everything about my story.
Yes. So, in fact, it's probably harder because it's longer since I looked at the notes.
I came to you literally about an hour after I'd finished making my notes, whereas now,
it's a discovery for both of us.
I'm like looking at these words like Brian. Anyway, I'll start it. I'm going to do a story about a guy called Brian Newcomb. And this comes from a book that I have mentioned before called Blood in the Glens by Jean McLennan. But it starts in Yorkshire in the summer of 1989.
Up north. In a Yorkshire.
That's awful. As someone who actually grew up in Yorkshire, that's horrendous.
My dad used to say I could do a brilliant Yorkshire accent. I did it on the way home from Yorkshire once. And then for weeks after his game, I was just thinking about your Yorkshire accent. It's brilliant. I just kept going, what's the time? And he was like, it's brilliant, it's brilliant. It's really good Yorkshire accent. You're really good, really, really good. And I was like, I can be an actress. No, I'll be a teachery podcast.
I mean, I lost my Yorkshire accent quite quickly. I don't even think I can do a good one anymore. I can do a Yorkshire accent, but I can't do the one I used to have.
Yeah.
I used to have a really broad Barnsley accent and I can't replicate it anymore, so I'm not going to try. Anyway, this happened in a village called Ingleton, and the locals were becoming worried about the apparent disappearance of an 88-year-old John Shuttleworth.
Two fat ladies, 88.
Yep. Also known as Jack to his friends.
That makes no sense. Like, if your name's John, what was his name? John?
John, yeah.
You can't shorten John to Jack. It's just a different name.
It is the same number of letters, to be fair.
Yeah.
What's to be gained?
John, Jack. It's no shorter. It's no more convenient.
John was his Sunday name. So, at his house, the milkman was delivering milk, and the milk that he'd delivered previously was still left out on the step. And the neighbours could hear that his phone was ringing constantly from inside his house, which is pure nostalgia for me. I always wanted to be a milkman as a kid growing up. So I could just work mornings and then I was done. Chill for the day.
Oh, I thought it was so you could snoop around people's houses. So you could have sex with housewives. Isn't that the...
When I bring the milk, I'm just going to drop it on the step and run. I'm not even knocking.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, the phone they could hear a lot. Incredibly loud, the old landlines. And basically, it was his daughter trying to get a hold of him, and because she was getting no response, she asked some of his neighbours if they would go around and check on the house, and making sure that they would check his shed cum workshop in the back. So when they did approach the shed, they saw that the door had been held shut across the outside with a piece of metal that had been jammed through the handles. And so they removed that and went inside, where they found the body of John Shuttleworth.
Jack Shuttleworth.
It was particularly bloody. He'd been bludgeoned in the head with a large piece of wood, and the murder weapon was still in the shed next to him. There was a single bloody fingerprint in the middle of the murder weapon, but unfortunately for the police, it turned out to belong to Mr. Shuttleworth.
Oh.
I do think that like forensic people must get so tired of making the joke, oh, a bloody fingerprint. Like, yeah, we've heard that one before. Bloody murder weapon again.
Not a detective. Yet. One day.
So his wallet was missing, and his sons told the police that he would often carry large sums of money around with him. He was known to be usually carrying anywhere between £500 to £1,000 just on his person.
See, I hate carrying a load of money. Like, with this car, I was going to pay cash because I got the money back from that one car. Oh, if you don't listen, if you don't have Patreon, you're not going to know the story. But I had cash on me for ages, and it just really stressed me out. I thought, people are going to know. They're going to attack me.
Well, I never carry cash. The woman who collects the tea and coffee money at school hates me. I'm like, what do you expect from me? Until you get a card reader, I'm drinking for free.
Yeah, who's got small change anymore?
Oh, it's not small fucking change. It's like £5 every 2 weeks. And she doesn't even buy...
Every 2 weeks?
And she doesn't even buy the milk.
Why is she charging you more?
If I could be asked to do the maths...
She is
embezzling me. She's embezzling me for tea. My house is full of tea. I should just take my own. But
that's insane. £5 every
2 weeks. I'm basically paying for her. Like, I'm paying her pension.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we had a lot of money. Well, the reason he had money on was not because of some grasping tea bitch that he worked with, but was because he had a keen interest in buying cars, fixing them up, selling them on. And so he was always wanting to be ready for a bargain, like if he saw something, because they go quick. John Shuttleworth had been a prize fighter back in his youth, in his earlier days. So he was really cavalier about having the money on him. And when his sons would try and tell him no, he would just say, oh, they'd have to kill me before they took the money off me.
And so they did.
Pretty much. So robbery seemed to be the most likely motive. So there were press conference appeals from the police, and the family also went on TV with some appeals for information about it. And some of the villagers did come forward with descriptions of a man they'd seen with Mr. Shuttleworth on his last day alive. And a few people recalled having seen Mr. Shuttleworth with a 5'8", dark-haired man with a swarthy complexion.
What's swarthy?
Dark. I think it's what they call white people who they're a bit like ethnically ambiguous people. They're like, ooh, swarthy.
Got a peasant's tan.
Ooh.
No, like, genuinely a white person with a tan. Used to be the peasants in
I think something like that. I don't think it means, like, actually dark-skinned, just, yeah, like, darkly complected. So I think it is a white person, just with dark features. Mm. That's all they mean. But so they saw him working on John's car with him outside his house. So police didn't release the description of this man because they wanted to maintain the integrity of any identifications they had. So they wanted any information that came in to be able to cross-reference it with the description, rather than people saying, yeah, I've seen a short, dark man. It's not really much to go on. Mm. So they continued with appeals and posters for information, but particularly about the missing wallet. And an empty wallet was eventually found, which would be identified as John's, by a woman who worked in a guest house. Well, she owned the guest house, only a few minutes away from where John lived. And it'd been found behind a wardrobe, which is pretty fucking impressive. Like, I want to stay in this guest house where they clean behind the wardrobes.
Yeah.
And the man who'd been staying there in the room, he matched the description of the man who was seen with John Shuttleworth. So she said that this guy's name was David, and he'd left in a hurry without paying, but had left one other item, which was a painting. And police would later find out that this painting was also stolen property. Police were able to match the painting to one half of a pair that had been stolen from another guest house about 30 miles away from Ingleton, where he had also left without paying, and he'd used the name David Rogers. However, this name didn't match any results with the criminal record check they carried out, so they were none the wiser. They were, however, able to follow the trail of this dark-haired man leaving guest houses without paying. So another B&B talked of a man called David Kerr, who had charmed everyone in the place, and he had been showing off two new paintings that he had acquired.
Stolen.
Exactly. But the police put the information on David Kerr, or David Rogers, into one of their bulletins that went around other police forces to say, here's something we're working on. If you know anything about it, we can compare notes. And in Strathclyde, they were also looking for a man known as David Kerr for the theft of some jewellery from a guest house on the island of Mull. So a few weeks before the murder of John Shuttleworth, David Kerr had been introduced to a woman named Anne Wood in the hotel bar. And at the end of the evening, after enjoying her company and telling her stories of his boats and homes back in New Zealand, where he claimed to live.
That made me think of boats and hoes.
I did think that when I was writing it. I was like, I wonder if anyone's going to catch my boats and homes. Could have said houses, but no.
Mate.
Which he said he was from New Zealand. So at the end of this evening, he'd just met this woman in a guest house and he proposed to her.
Oh, blimey.
So,
stealing hearts as well as paintings.
Exactly, a true thief. But surprisingly, the next day, Anne actually said yes. Though, unsurprisingly, her teenage daughter was not happy by this union.
I love it's the wrong way around. It's like the teenage daughter is like, no, mum.
Well, Jean McLennan, the author of the book, tried to make out, well, it was probably just teenage antipathy. No, I think she's like, that's not typical teenage bad mood. That's
common sense.
Yeah, she met a man for an hour.
Yeah.
And she's going to marry him. So they started to spend time together. And a few days later, David Kerr, with Anne and her family, took a ferry from Mull to Oban. And on the crossing, Kerr presented Anne with an engagement ring that was supposed to befit a man of his wealth. So they got to the mainland and David Kerr said, okay, just hold on a minute. I'm going to go make a phone call about a couple of things. I'll be back. But that was the last that they ever saw of him.
That's a bit weird then. Why would he do a runner at that point? He's already given away an expensive ring, which I assume was stolen.
Well, when they got back home and found out that the ring he had given her actually belonged to her friend, Eileen Stanmore, and was part of a whole load of stolen jewellery he'd taken from her. So she was the woman that had introduced them and ran the B&B where he'd been staying. David Kerr robbed all her jewellery, totalling around £35,000.
Oh, God.
And then fucked off. One good thing in terms of the investigation did come out of this is that because he'd been trying to play happy families for a few days, he had been foolish enough to have his photograph taken yes. with Anne and her family, which of course was handed over to the police, and they now had a bit more of a lead. So this trail of unpaid rooms and stolen goods was followed?
Got up northern now.
This trail of unpaid rooms and stolen goods was followed to a place called Tongue, spelt like your tongue.
Yeah.
But it could be tongue. Because some people call a tongue a tongue.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
I say tongue.
Let's call the whole fucking podcast off. Dan.
It's laughter or slaughter.
We'll never know. Except the fact that I say it at the beginning of every episode.
Yeah, it's clearly slaughter.
Oh no, we're pronouncing our podcast wrong, don't
we? Oh, yeah.
One star.
They can't even say the name of it.
Why would they invent a name of a podcast and then not read it properly?
That's a good point.
So they went to this place called Tongue, where they didn't go to the guest house, but in the town, bar staff in the town recognised David Kerr. And they said, oh yeah, we know this guy. He's been around here charming the women. He tried to give one of the barmaids a couple of rings.
I wondered what you're going to say then.
A Roger.
I've been listening too much. My dad wrote a porno, if I'm honest. Fricking, she said today.
What's fricking? What that is. So they were getting, I hope it's not rude, because I say that in front of the children.
Oh, you shouldn't.
What, frigging?
Still an expletive.
I say flipping and they freak out. They're like, you swore.
Well,
it's. And I did play a video that said bullshit twice. And I was on edge for 4 days being like, someone's going to complain.
Twice!
Someone's going to complain. Well, the first time I was like, oops. It was a poem.
Oops. Well, I'll leave it playing. Oh, did you play a video you hadn't watched?
I had watched it. That's the worst thing. So it was a poem about our hometown. And in geography, we're comparing our hometown to...
It sounds like you've dubbed that in our hometown over the top of what you said.
Yeah, well, might as well. So anyway, so in geography, we're comparing our hometown to Paris because that's the setting of Hugo, which is the book we're doing. Anyway, so I was like playing this. I'd been sent this poem about our hometown and I'd listened to it, watched the whole thing. And it obviously just washed over me because I'd watched the whole thing and then I showed it to the kids. The first time it said shit, I was like, okay, he sort of mumbled it, a few little glances, no one really cottoned on. Second time he said bullshit really clearly. So I had to pause it and I just looked at all the children and went, we can be sensible, can't we?
Anyway.
So he gave two rings to a barmaid. So they knew they were getting closer. So police arrived at a place called the Smoo Cave Hotel the day after Kerr had just skipped out on his bill. So they were really hot on his tail. He had made himself known to the staff there as being a bit of a flash git.
They didn't like him.
No, he was bragging about his boats and homes again and offering to buy the hotel... Even though
that wasn't for sale.
Yeah, that wasn't for sale.
I will buy your estate. We don't want you to. I put a lot of effort into this. I've been here for years. Yeah. No, I will buy it.
I think it'd been recently sold. And he was like, no, scrap that. I'll buy it. And he even gave over a check for about £40,000 for a deposit. But the check was registered to the account of a Mrs. Margaret McConey. He'd also befriended a French couple... And he told them that he was a boat importer and that he needed a lift to pick up the boat and then he was going to sail it back to the buyer. And they'd stayed with him in a lodge and also left without paying. The only thing that had left behind was a backpack. And this would turn out to also be the property of this Margaret McConey. So August 22nd, police held a press conference, this time releasing the photograph in Scotland. But also, this was the day that Margaret McConey was reported missing. So at the time of her disappearance, she was 55, widowed, and living in Glasgow with her adult daughter. She worked as a carer for an elderly man and had decided to take the summer off to go on a walking holiday. So her daughter had said, yeah, sure, just make sure you contact me regularly. And on the 11th of August, she'd phoned home. And Margaret then told her daughter of this wonderful, wealthy man she'd just met. She also said that he'd proposed to her and she was actually seriously considering accepting. But they were going to continue on her walking holiday together.
If my mum went on a singles holiday recently and I thought, I wonder if she'll find a companion. But if she had phoned me engaged, I would have lost my shit. I'd have been like, without me meeting him. And approving. Yeah, I'd thought she'd have lost her mind. I'd have been, yeah.
Well, consider the fact that she may be being conned or kidnapped.
Yeah.
Arlene, if you're listening, think again. She'd get really offended if she's that. She'd be like, why wouldn't they be interested in me? I can just hear her now being like, someone may propose to me.
She's never going to listen to this. If she does, I won't be on next week's episode.
So, other than another postcard, that was the last contact that Margaret would have with her daughter, and she didn't arrive home as planned. So a search for the missing woman began, and the pair were traced to a guest house in Tongue, where the barmaid with the ring job was.
All these words.
They'd checked in as a couple on a walking holiday, and then gone out together for a walk on the 16th of August. But David Kerr had returned alone, saying that Margaret had met some friends and just decided to go off with them instead. The next day he left but did pay, which suggests that perhaps he didn't want to have any attention drawn to this particular visit.
Yeah.
So the two rings that he'd given away to this barmaid were then taken and shown to Margaret's family, and they said that they were her jewellery.
Oh.
So on the 24th of August, so 2 days after she was reported missing, Mrs. Margaret McConey's body was found. She had been killed by blows to the head with a rock and she'd been buried in a shallow grave near Tongue. The next day, police released the photograph of Kerr to the English press. So until then, again, they hadn't wanted to show it and get any false identifications on the man that had killed Jack Shuttleworth. John Shuttleworth. They wanted to try and make sure that no one gave any false identifications. But now, with two people killed, they suspect he's a serial killer on the loose. Public safety is more important than this conviction. They just need to catch him. So, I always wonder about this. A relative of the man in the photograph came forward.
Oh.
I always think, you know, when you see them on Crime Watch, like, they must have an entire family who see that and think, fuck.
Yeah, moral dilemma.
Like, can you imagine if you saw your brother?
I'd shop him in a heartbeat. But I think probably if they were that, I think you'd probably have suspicions anyway. That they're a bit of a wrong
one. Depends how far away they are. If I saw the lodger on Crime Watch, I'd be too frightened to dob him in yet, because he's fucking living here.
Yeah.
I'd have to get him to move, which I'm trying to anyway. I'd have to get him to move out and then dob him.
Does he listen to the podcast?
I don't know. I don't think so. He has occasionally.
Just go upstairs and tell him no.
Move out! So anyway, a relative of this, the man in the photograph, came forward and identified him, not as David Rogers, not as David Kerr, but as 50-year-old mechanic Brian Newcombe from Nottinghamshire. So this guy had been married twice, but he had been living in a small mining village of Huthwaite with his elderly mother and disabled sister. Newcombe was known to be a bit of a loner and a liar in the village. He was one of those guys who'd be down the pub, always with a story about something he was up to, money he had, proper bullshit. And he had a record for petty theft that spanned decades. He was always getting in trouble. But at the time of his identification, Newcombe hadn't been in Huthwaite for over 6 weeks. And his wife had thought, oh, he's obviously just run off with another woman.
He's married.
Yeah. He's always trying to chat people up. He's obviously gone off with someone. He's been gone for over a month now. So she'd moved out and gone to live with her mother. And information continued to flood in with all the different aliases that he had used. Gary Kerr, David Kerr, Phil Kerr. But to almost everyone, he said that he was a rich guy from New Zealand. And he was conning his way into the affections of many women, proposing to them, and then stealing from them.
So was he doing a New Zealand accent the whole time?
No! I think he was trying to say, like, he was some sort of expat.
Oh.
Chilling in Scotland. But he said that he was an engineer, a doctor, a boat importer. He even went for a bomb disposal expert.
I'd love if there had been a bomb that day. Like, we've got the guy right here.
Is there a bomb disposal expert in the house?
Or a doctor. They kind of got him on that one.
Exactly.
He'd probably just step in and try and save him.
30th of August, Newcombe checked into a guest house with two other men. So now his picture had been released. He obviously knew he was being hunted. And he knew that travelling alone or with a woman would make him more easily identifiable, because they were looking for a single man or a man with a woman. So he met two men in a pub and he'd promised them work on an oil rig, saying, oh, come with me, I've got work for you, we'll hook up. And said that the rooms were going to be paid for on the company. But police were hot on his trail and had been thought that he would be heading back to sort of the East Midlands area at some point. So they were looking at guest houses around there. And they'd actually visited the guest house he was in earlier in the day as part of this manhunt.
I don't think, it's got to be quite easy to catch him by then. It's like on Hunted, where they release a photo, say money for information, and people start just calling and saying, yeah, they've just checked in now. So if they're on the look for someone and he's going to the similar sorts of places, it doesn't take long to catch him.
Exactly. So police were notified of his location in this guest house, and they said leave the door unlocked, because we don't want him to know that we're actually coming. We just want to be able to sneak in. So 8 officers entered Newcombe's room and arrested him. His companions were also arrested, but after an interview, it was thought that they'd clearly been duped by his stories and they were not aware that he was wanted for murders at all. So Newcombe was interviewed at Skipton Station in Yorkshire, where he admitted to both murders and seemed to show little remorse for his actions. He said that he'd met John Shuttleworth when he stopped to help him fix his car, but that while they were in the shed getting bits and bobs, John had become argumentative and sort of tried to lash out at him. So Newcomb had smacked him in the head with some wood.
Aww.
So he was basically saying, well, it was his own fault. He got mouthy with me, so I got bashed him in the head till he died. And he just saw the wallet sticking out of his pocket and took the opportunity.
Got in for a penny, in for a pound. Mm.
So he claimed that also that while he was out with Margaret on their walk on the 16th of August, she'd confronted him with the fact that he was wanted by the police in connection with the murder in Ingleton, and he was worried that she was going to turn him in, so that's why he hit her on the head with a rock.
I don't buy it.
Well, it wasn't true at all, because the details hadn't yet been released to the press at that time. But he gave no other explanation during his time in custody.
That's upsetting for the family, though, isn't it? Because they just want some reasons why, don't they? Just want the full story.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about her that obviously he felt like he couldn't get away from her easily, or that she was too clever. She was maybe spotting, maybe more like that, she was spotting holes in his stories. Yeah.
Or knew too much about him.
Yeah. So he was expected to sit two trials, one in England and one in Scotland. And he was placed in a high security wing. He had been in hospital. He was on suicide watch, being checked on regularly. But on the 13th of November, the same year, 1989, he was found hanging from the bars in his cell window. He'd blocked the peephole with a piece of paper so they couldn't check on him. And he'd used strips from his bed sheets to hang himself. He had left three suicide notes, one for his wife, one for his mother, and one for his solicitor. But in none of them did he apologise to the victims, apologise to the victims' families, show any remorse for what he'd done. He basically just said the reason he wanted to kill himself was because he couldn't live with people thinking he was a murderer, which he
which they was. Did, because you did.
And we do.
So,
tough.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
We still think you're a murderer, dead or alive. So there's that.
And that's it.
Right. Here's my... This is a grim one. I'm just, like, warning a grim one. But it's sort of similar to Suzanne Capper, if you can remember her, and her terrible treatment. But we had a message on Twitter, and I know this has been sort of talked about by a few podcasts recently, about whether we cover people of different ethnicities. And I don't think... I don't think we consciously don't or consciously do. I think because we focus on murderers, we don't really... And we've looked at lots of murderers of different ethnicities, but I'm not sure that's really what people are looking for.
We have done a couple of victims of colour. Is it disrespectful that I don't remember the victim's name?
I don't remember any of the victims'
names. I've just explained to you that I don't remember the story I told a week ago.
I'm not very good with names. I don't know anything.
You're not very good with faces either.
I'm really bad with faces, and I always thought I was okay with names.
You're absolutely fucked because your facial recognition is so bad. Watching a film with or something with Lucy, you're like, oh, what's that person from?
She's no clue. She thinks she saw them in Sainsbury's.
If Lucy's IDing anyone in a identity parade, you need to be fucking worried.
Honestly,
because it's basically luck of the draw.
Yeah.
She'll have any one of you.
So when I meet my new groups, and just for ages, I'm just like, that's just another blonde girl. Blonde girl, generic blonde girl.
The little white blonde girls. Like, when every time I get a new class, I'm like, look, you're all going to have to start differentiating yourself with headbands.
Yeah, with those names on.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't know who you are. You're just blonde child to me. So I've been meaning to do this one for a while, is the case of Victoria Climbay, which is quite a well-known one among the sort of teachers and social workers, I would think, because it is quite a massive case. And I wanted to cover it because she is a young woman of colour, but also it's just such a massive UK case. So
this case I know about already. We had to do it at uni. We've had to do it on safeguarding courses. It changed legislation in this country in terms of safeguarding children massively. And it's a horrible way for it to have to happen, but...
You'll see why.
It's going to be remembered forever because it did just change things.
So if it's not particularly funny, then it's probably for the best, to be honest.
I don't know that anything we do is particularly funny.
It's well researched. Give us that.
Clear.
So we come out both ears.
But don't wear headphones while driving.
Can you not?
No! What? This one, like, someone was like, oh, well, when I'm driving with my headphones in. Like, you shouldn't be driving with your headphones in anyway.
I do that because if I'm going fast, I can't hear it.
Do you, Lucy?
A little bit.
Okay, of course you can't hear it because you're supposed to be listening to the fucking road.
Yeah, but then I can hear all the noises my car makes. It freaks me out. So, serious. Victoria was born in 1991. So this is quite a recent case. And she was born in Abobo, which is in Côte d'Ivoire. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong, but it's in West Africa.
Côte d'Azur?
No. Oh. Côte d'Ivoire. I think. Ivoire.
Oh, okay.
It's in West Africa.
The Ivory Coast.
It's a small country and it's got an official language of French. So she was fluent in French. She left the country in 2000, aged 9, to live in France with her great aunt, who was called Marie-Thérèse Couau. Now, her parents had allowed her to go and Victoria was happy to go, and she was chosen out of the family over her three brothers, but her parents had only met Kowal a few times. But I know that sounds really unusual for us. It wasn't that unusual an arrangement in their society. I think because they felt by someone travelling abroad, it was such a good opportunity that they would be more willing to let their children go if there was an opportunity.
And she was a family member, wasn't she? She was an auntie.
She was a great aunt. So they were really happy with it. What was happening. So Victoria travelled under the name Anna Kowal, and was called Anna from then on. So she wasn't known as Victoria when she was living in France or England, because Kowal had originally planned to take a girl called Anna. I don't think she was a relative. I think she just happened to have the same last name. But the family had changed their mind and she just thought, oh, well, they look sort of similar. I'll just stick her on her passport.
So it was like pretty much chance that Victoria even ended up going on this trip.
Yeah. Oh. It was going to be Anna. But she just thought it's easier just to change the kid's name than the passport, I guess.
Yeah.
So Kowal and Victoria moved to Paris and Victoria went to school. Now, it's quite good in France for her because obviously she spoke French.
Yes.
She could understand the language. But she began to be quite absent at school and the school got social services involved. And she would come to school very tired. And at one point she had had her head shaved and she came in wearing a wig and teachers started to ask questions as they thought things just weren't quite right. And her great aunt had told them that she had a skin condition, but it still raised all these questions and social services were sniffing around quite a lot. So after only a few months in Paris, Victoria and Kowal left France and moved to West London, where they lived at a bed and breakfast. Now, there's different kinds of bed and breakfasts. So you can have like a hotel type bed and breakfast, but you also get bed and breakfasts, which are basically people's private homes where they rent out a room to the council if they need, almost like a council house, but they'll do it privately. And the council will just pay whatever they're charging to put someone up so they're not on the street, basically. So I think it was one of those bed and breakfasts, right, basically. So they moved into that. And I think it was quite clear that Kuel only really wanted Victoria around to get accommodation easier. So in this kind of situation, because if she'd been a woman on her own, they would have just put her at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
Whereas with a child, automatically you say, well, you can't have a child on the street, therefore you move up. Victoria couldn't speak any English, so she was completely isolated. And social workers, again, were involved in her being placed because it was a child and therefore they had to secure her a place, so they would be involved at that point. But they didn't try talking to her and they didn't really get any translators. So,
which I'm really surprised at, because she's speaking French, which it's not like we're devoid of French speakers here. Yeah. Like, everyone learns it at school. I mean, I didn't even learn it past year eight, and I could still be like, bonjour.
Yeah.
If she was like, je m'appelle Victoria, I'd be like, something doesn't seem right with Anna.
Yeah. I think probably she'd been told to go by Anna by her great aunt, and obviously she's the only person that she knows. But they weren't really worried about Victoria anyway, because although she looked a bit dirty and she was quite small, they thought that really that Kuel was making her look worse because she wanted a nicer accommodation, or she wanted it all to happen faster,
hamming it up for sympathy.
Yeah. So Victoria didn't start school in the UK, even though you'd think that would be the first thing that they would do, get her into school. But she spent most of her time at Priscilla Cameron's house, which was a lady that Kuel had met out and about, and she had asked her to childmind for her. Didn't really know her, just another woman that she'd met. And Priscilla Cameron said that she did sometimes notice cuts on Victoria's hands, but she asked Kuel about it, and she said that Victoria had been playing with razor blades, you know, as young children do.
Yep, classic razor blade play. Although, I had a razor blade incident when I was a child. I remember it was like a family party, and my auntie brought out this little tin box that had belonged to her granddad during the war.
Yeah.
And inside it was like a couple of his little bits and pieces that he would have with him in the trenches or something. And like,
question mark.
Trench? And in it, there were some razor blades that he would use to shave, obviously. And like at the time, like, you know, on TV, if someone gets handed like a sword or a new blade that's just been sharpened, like, can you imagine in a cartoon, and like they take a finger or a thumb and they just run it along the edge of the blade and like, yeah, that's a good blade, that's so sharp. So I picked up this razor blade and I just ran my thumb right across the top of it, thinking like, I'll see how sharp this is, but just sliced completely, like sliced myself like butter. But then I was so embarrassed because I didn't want to explain to anyone how I'd completely sliced across myself. But like, I deliberately, afterwards, like, you're a fucking idiot. Like, why would you even do that on a blade? I thought it was magic. I don't know what I thought. So I didn't want to tell anyone. So I remember like having my thumb in a fist, and then the blood started seeping through my through my fingers.
That is classic Emma trying to be polite and trying to hide some real problem that you're having.
I just had this bloody fist in my pocket because I was like, I didn't want to tell anyone that I'd cut myself on the street, so I just had this like,
Jesus.
I looked like I'd murdered someone, and I got in the car to go home. I was like, mother,
like, help me. Emma, I'll get the first aid kit that I carry around.
Definitely, like, awkward social situations, repress everything.
But I don't think she was doing that. I think someone was actively.
You only need to do
up.
That once.
Yeah.
You don't have several cuts from that.
So that was another suspicious thing, but no one reported anything because she just went, yeah, fine, okay, whatever. So the family, Victoria and Kuel met up with a distant relative of Kuel in London, who happened to be in London as well. She was called Esther Akar, and she was immediately concerned about Victoria's appearance. So she just thought, this child is not healthy and not living her best life. So she did what you should do and phoned social services and said that she had real concerns over Victoria, that she had scars on her face, she had signs of harm, and that she didn't think where they were living was unsuitable. And you'd really think, in the perfect world, that would be the end of it. Social services intervene, yeah. End of, this child's picked up as someone who's going through abuse. Didn't happen. So the referral went in, but no one dealt with it, and it just seemed to disappear.
Like, how injured do you have to be before someone steps in?
Well, I think they were planning on investigating it, but it just went missing. I mean, I don't know if this was pre-computers and it was filing systems, but when you actually had to write things on notes of paper, which I can't imagine doing now. But
it might even just have been the case that just information wasn't shared, which I think is why we talk about it now, because it just shows the importance of sharing information. Yeah. And like, if you have a concern, you report it to one place, like say you report to social services, they then now have to tell the school as well and tell the...
But I think they didn't even investigate this referral. Obviously you have a referral, but to make it even worse, Esther phoned again days later just to check that it had been dealt with, and they...
So she was that concerned. She wasn't like, oh, I'll just phone it in, my job's done. She's like, I need to chase this up.
Yeah, she's like, I've not heard anything. I know that she's still there. I guess she was probably expecting Kuel to give her an angry phone call saying, what have you been saying about me? But nothing happened. And she phoned up again. And they basically said, well, if you've made a referral, then it's probably being dealt with. But they didn't do a whole new referral. It wasn't considered a new problem. And therefore, the old one had gone missing and then nothing was ever done. So I think nowadays, if someone phones again, they treat it as a new referral. And therefore it sort of triggers again.
Right.
But then they didn't. They were just like, yeah, it's probably sorted. So this was a completely missed opportunity by social services to step in and look after Victoria. Kuel had now met a guy called Carl Manning, who was a bus driver, and they began a relationship. I think they met on the bus. They just started chatting.
She just refused to get off. She's like, if you want to get me off here, you're going to have to carry me.
To take me on a date. So they started dating, and only 2 weeks after they met, Kuel and Victoria moved into Carl Manning's flat.
Ugh, surely the first time you've met a, like, clearly neglected child, you'd be like, she's not, like...
This isn't the relationship for me.
Yeah, she's not able to look after a child. She's not a nice person. How's she going to
cook me dinner? I don't know.
She's just a nasty person.
You'd think, wouldn't you? But there's all sorts in this world, Emma. I hate to break it.
Do you think people don't care if people are mean to kids? Are there people... actually, I know that's true.
There's loads of cases where people have picked sex offenders over their own children and had their children removed because they'd rather be with this man.
It's looking like that.
Yeah. So they moved into his flat, and social workers had no idea where they'd gone. So even if they were involved, there was, you know, they sort of disappeared. And they didn't really try and find her because obviously this referral hadn't gone through. The social workers working with her previously were like, well, we got a housing job done. So she sort of disappeared. So on 13th of July, only a week after Kuel and Victoria had moved in with Carl, Kuel went to ask Priscilla Cameron, this babysitter, if she could have Victoria full time because Carl didn't really like her. She's a bit of a drag having his child around. Yeah, so she said to Priscilla, can you take this child that I've moved to England with and just have her after all that? Priscilla said, good God, no. That's a weird thing to ask me.
Sacre bleu!
But she did say that she would let Victoria sleep over. So, obviously, Victoria's not been away from this house for a long time for an overnight stay. So when getting her ready for bed... Priscilla and her two sort of grown-up-ish children, I think one was a teenager at school, the boy, and then the girl, I think, had her own children, so she was probably in her 20s, maybe. And they discover scars all over Victoria, all over her body, all over her face. There was a burn on her. And Priscilla asked Kuel about what had happened, and she said that Victoria had done it to herself, as children do. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of places you can't reach on your own body as well.
Priscilla and her children took Victoria to see her son's French teacher. I assume because he's a French teacher, it's because they thought maybe she could talk to him and explain these scars.
Yeah.
But he took one look at her and said, take her to hospital. So they did
that.
So
it was that obvious that all he had to do was meet her.
Yeah.
And say she should.
Well, I think they were like, she's got these scars. And he was like, take her to the hospital right now, which is probably good advice. And so Avril, the daughter, took her straight to the hospital. Now, Victoria was seen by quite a few doctors, and they asked her about her injuries, and she did say that she'd done them to herself.
Right.
Which she was probably primed for saying. She clearly hadn't, because she couldn't. So she was kept in hospital and she was placed in police custody because of these concerns. Now, Kuau obviously was brought in to the hospital to speak to them, and she said that Victoria had scabies and she had scratched at herself with various instruments because of the pain that it's causing. And the paediatrician went along with this being a possibility, despite not speaking to Victoria about it, not getting someone who could speak to her.
Is scabies itself not a sign of neglect? Like, how do you get scabies? Should that not be a red flag anyway?
Well, I think anyone can get scabies. I think it's little creatures that burrow under your skin.
Yeah, but is that not a signal? If a child has scabies, is that not a signal like she's not getting looked after properly?
I think a little bit, but they sort of thought social services would investigate that, but that's not a reason to keep her in a hospital indefinitely.
Just a cheeky dose of scabies.
I was diagnosed with scabies once, falsely. I was working on a kids' camp.
Falsely. I was falsely accused of having scabies.
I was working on this kids' camp that was in a youth hostel where, like, travellers stay. People who are travelling around the UK stay for cheap. We had, like, 6 beds in a dorm type thing.
Yeah.
And we were staying in a room. And every night we were getting bitten. And we had, like, we'd wake up with all these bites on us. And one of my roommates stayed up one night. She said she could actually see the bed bugs crawling on the bed.
No.
And, like, she was swatting them. And there were, like, little patches of blood where she'd swatted them. But they'd obviously got her blood in there. It's disgusting. And we went to the doctors about it. Because that's what the leader of the camp, it was like 20, 25 or something. Like, a leader camp. That's what she said. And the doctor said, I think it's scabies. And we were like, I'm sure it's bed bugs. It's like, no, probably scabies. And because of that, we had to be quarantined into a room away from the kids for about a week and not do any work. So we just sat and watched films and ate crap all day.
Loves it.
But it's stupid because other workers came in and sat with us all the time anyway. I was like, this is hardly
scabies.
So as a result, she was allowed to go home because they said, well, maybe she is scratching scabies. And no actions were put in place. Police also didn't visit Victoria, even though part of the process of her having been on police custody and then being removed from it was that they have a visit to the house, and they just didn't bother. So another missed opportunity to save Victoria. All the services trusted each other that things were going on, but she was just completely left. So on July 24th, still the same month, that she'd just been in hospital and had these concerns, Victoria was taken back to hospital with severe burns on her.
Ooh.
Really awful. So this time, there wasn't any sign of scabies, and the hospital immediately suspected abuse. However, the doctor still wrote in her notes, despite considering that this child might be at risk, able to discharge. And when she was asked later, she said that she was basically saying that the girl can walk, like she's able to, she's physically able,
yeah,
she's
like,
healthy enough to go.
If you want to put her in foster care, she can be taken now.
Yeah, whereas because she'd written that in the notes, the hospital, the other staff read that as, oh, it's fine to send her home, and they sent her home. So real issue with these notes, absolutely ridiculous, and she got sent home again. So social workers who were expected to visit after she was discharged cancelled their visit because they'd heard about the scabies. I don't know if they were scared of catching it or something, or they thought, oh, well, that's fine then. There's
all
an explanation.
Our concerns are now gone away. Like, she's just riddled with diseases, not my problem.
Yeah. They also believed Kuau's stories that she had said that Victoria had poured boiling water over herself because she'd been itching so much, which, logic. I mean, what child is going to just tip hot water on themselves because that's more pleasant than itching? So they
it's
just
also ridiculous
it.
Because like if a kid told me a story that even if a kid said to me, I poured boiling water on myself, I would be like, right, why was no one watching you when you did it?
Yeah.
Which is fine, because kids do stuff, and you can't watch them 24/7. I'm not trying to pass judgment on any parents. Like, they do stuff when you're not watching and you can't be there all the time. But if it's a kid that has got other injuries and...
Yeah. Or is off school fit. A lot, and well, she's not even in school.
So and no one was watching them pouring water. Well, this is the problem. Maybe she'd been in school. I'd have saved her.
Yeah, but she wasn't even in school. So there's literally no one getting involved daily in her life. So God knows what she was going through at this stage. So following this, social services again tried to take up the case and look into it because she was on the books and they thought we'd probably better investigate. But they locked on the door. She wasn't there. So they decided, oh, she's probably... moved away, therefore we're going to close the case. So Manning at this point had started, and this is through his interviews later on, but he said that he was forcing Victoria to sleep in the bath every night because she wet the bed, which wetting the bed is a sign of abuse, as well as defecating. And he was just, I think, just like, oh, that's disgusting. She could sleep in the bath. We're not cleaning the sheets every night. She was having this horrific... I mean, who was this Carl who was just like, yeah, I'm all right with that?
Yeah, or... like, how do you randomly meet someone? I would have thought that being an abuser was so rare that the chances of you meeting a guy on a bus who fancies you and also happens to love abusing kids is like...
Fred and Rosie and Amira. I don't know. I mean, I think if... I guess if... if the case hadn't been like that, then we wouldn't have heard about it. So it's just bad luck, like really bad luck. Social services, again, did try and visit because they hadn't quite closed the case yet. And the paediatrician from the hospital had called them and said, whatever happened to that girl who was clearly being abused? And they're like, we sent her home. So they tried to visit again. They didn't speak to Victoria or try to get her into school, which would have been key in her
If only
safety.
To stop fucking... Patricia having to babysit her all the bloody time. Yeah. Like, you'd think, if you don't like having her around this much, like, she's so annoying to you, get her in school.
Yeah.
Then you don't have to see her for hours of the day.
So, Kuau at this point applied for a house to move away from Manning. They'd obviously been having arguments or things weren't working out. And when she went to ask about this, she was told that she wasn't a priority because they had somewhere they could stay, which was his house, and Victoria wasn't at risk. However, she then started saying that Manning was sexually abusing Victoria. Now, right. She was clearly making it up she's clearly talking out about it to try and get a new house. However, the next day she withdrew the allegation. So social workers kind of went, oh, well, she was obviously lying to get a new house and didn't investigate that as they would have if she hadn't have dropped it. I think probably she thought, oh, God, they're going to come investigate now. And, I'm abusing this child.
Maybe she was just angry at Manning and decided, oh, here's a way that I can get back at him.
Yeah.
And then realised, oh, fuck, this is going to drop me in it too.
Yeah. So, Victoria needed to go to hospital again, but Kuau just stopped taking her. So instead, she started taking Victoria to church. So she told the pastor that Victoria had demons inside her and that her injuries were due to demonic possession. And in response, he prayed over her to try and cast out the demons. She also said Satan had told Victoria to burn herself, and that's why she had burns on her. I mean, what kind of pastor is looking at this child and saying, yeah, all right, then I'll give a prayer and on you go.
Exactly. Everyone knows the devil doesn't speak French. Like, I know you believe in God, but you still also believe that people are dickheads too.
The thing is, I mean, this isn't that long ago, and we were in church. And we
it's not medieval times when you're like...
Oh, we had training saying you'd have to report, so I'm sure we were aware...
Yeah.
When we did church work, that we had a responsibility.
Maybe it's different because we worked with the Salvation Army. It's very much charity employment stuff, don't they? Whereas other churches can just... Like, you can just pop... You can be a church.
Yeah.
Like, my kitchen could be a church.
Could it?
You're in it right now. Yeah. Do you want to pray?
No.
Well, then get out of my church.
Oh. So, from October to January... Not much is known about Victoria's life, apart from that we can assume it was horrific. She was sleeping in the bath, we know that. She didn't go to school, she didn't go to hospital, so no one was involved in her life outside of her abusers. So the tragedy of this story is really sort of how cut off she was and how alone she was. Now, social workers tried to visit three times, but because they received no reply, they assumed that the family had moved away. So eventually... she'd been on the books for a while, and they decided it was time just to give up and close the case for Victoria Kalimbe and assume that she'd just moved away and she was under someone else's priority list now. And the day, sadly, that they closed the case happened to be the day that Victoria died, on the 25th of February 2000. So she'd, on the day that she died, she'd been taken to a church by Coel and was severely malnourished. She had organ failure, she had hypothermia, she was in an absolutely dreadful state. And the pastor at this church told her to take her to the hospital because clearly she was going to die. So she was rushed to intensive care and she died just hours later. She had 128 injuries and scars on her body, including cigarette burns, evidence of being tied up, marks from hammers and marks from chains. So the abuse that she was suffering was intense. And both Coel and Manning were arrested and charged with child cruelty and murder, quite rightly. So an inquiry was launched to find out why. And with so many services, so with doctors, police, social workers being involved in her short life, why no one had stepped in and said, this is a child being abused, we need to remove her immediately, and why she was left to suffer. So as well as poor management of the case, so things going missing, many had said that Victoria's race had actually played quite a big part as well, because it meant that people were slightly scared of being accused of racism, for one. But also the fact that Victoria was quite quiet and clearly quite scared of Coel, they sort of maybe thought maybe a racial thing, like a sign of respect, maybe.
Or like a culture.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe in their culture this is how children treat their parents, maybe as a sign of respect, and didn't treat it maybe in the same way that they might have with a white child, where they would have just thought, well, I know that this clearly is abuse. All these errors obviously had resulted in such a tragic ending, and Manning and Coel received life imprisonment and social workers were suspended. Now, they were suspended with full pay, which I find...
It's not really a suspense, is it? That's holiday.
Yeah. And they were investigated. The idea was, look, this has been horrific and the safeguards weren't in place and therefore we learn from it and we make changes immediately. But that didn't happen. Only 2 years later, after Victoria's death, Ainley Walker, another young black child, only two, was found dead, having been abused and starved, also having social work involvement, but who had failed to make visits and failed to step in. So really, really two terrible, terrible cases. So Victoria and Ainley's death contributed to a lot of changes in child protection law and improvements in communication between different services, to ensure that children don't slip through the net like this. And this is why we learn about it as teachers and take it as, you know, really, really important that we have. I mean, we have safeguarding training all the time, don't we? I mean,
yeah, you have to have it every couple of years.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it is tiring and people do moan about it, but it is so, so important. Because of cases like this where she was subjected to the most awful experiences. And I just thought it was an important case to cover because...
Yes. Use your platform.
Yeah. So...
Thank you for giving us the platform.
Yeah, thank you for listening. And there's not really much else to say.
Mm-mm.
So...
Sorry to leave you on a downer, but
sometimes life is a downer.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.